Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I am pleased to have as my guest Brian Evanson, whose most recent book, The Open Curtain, has been published by Coffee House Press. The last two books were The Wavering Knife, which came from Fiction Collective 2, and Dark Property, which came from Black Square Editions. Now, when I'm talking to people about new writers, and it's foolish to say young writers anymore, people most frequently tell me about Brian Evanson. And I wanted to begin by asking, you have won the International Horror Guild Award, and there are quotes from, among other people, Peter Straub on the book. Uh-huh. And I wondered whether you feel an affinity with horror writing or whether it's the back door through which you entered.
That's an interesting question. I think that I do feel a connection to people like Lovecraft, and I think to Straub's work, his best work especially.
The second thing I wanted to bring up is that people like Mary Caponegro, who's been on the show, talk of you as a comic writer. This one I find a little bit harder mm-hmm. to take in. What is your feeling about that? This goes back, I want listeners to know, to an issue that was, in a sense, initiated by John Hawkes, mm-hmm. whose work was frequently very dark, very gory. His first novel featured an ex-Nazi who sits down to butcher and eat a young child. The book was called The Cannibal. And so one day when he announced to people that he considered himself to be primarily a comic writer, this came as a big surprise. But I think that dark comedy has gone several revolutions beyond the kinds of enunciation that Hawks was attempting to make. And I wondered what your relation to the idea of the comic is.
Well, I think my work is very comic. I do think that this book is deliberately a little bit flatter, but I still think that there are moments which are comic, which serve partly as a relief, but partly they kind of intensify the things that are going on around them. My experience reading someone like Kafka, who I think of as both a very, very serious writer and dark writer and as a comic writer, is that you when you're reading things, you laugh, and then that laughter becomes very nervous. And I think that's what I've tried to do with this book. But I think that there's often elements that that turn to the comic. I'm interested in that, and I'm interested in the tension between the comic and the sometimes the grotesque. And I think I agree that Hawks does this thing where he's bringing together the comic and often the grotesque and also the romantic. And it's that kind of movement between those three things that makes his work feel so textured and complex and interesting. And I think that's, for me as well, there's an attempt to have a kind of movement through a texture. And so every time it seems to be reaching a point where people have figured out what's going on, there's going to be a shift or a change.
Now, this book represents a kind of culmination of sorts, and as a result, it's sort of an autobiographical novel in its way, much more so, perhaps, than things that preceded it.
Yeah.
In 1995, you were asked by Brigham Young University to do them the favor of not publishing another book like your first book, Altman's Tongue. Uh-huh. As I understand it, a student had brought to their attention the idea that a professor should not be writing this way.
Right. There was a student who wrote an anonymous letter to a Mormon church leader saying that my work was promoting various sorts of evil, and saying that this was wrong for a professor at Brigham Young University to be doing. It's a Mormon school there. And So that ended up leading to a series of events that ended up with them deciding that I'd be welcome to stay as long as I just wouldn't write anything else like Altman's Tongue.
And you, in the subsequent events, left the school, left the church, mm-hmm. left a marriage as well.
Right.
In order to protect your ability to write about anything, to address the issues of Mormonism, had it been particularly an affront to Mormonism that was at issue there?
Well, Altman's Tongue, I think, has very little to do with Mormonism. I don't think there's really any visual reference to it within the text itself or anything that you can feel in the text. And I think part of the response was to the jacket copy, which talks about my connection to Mormonism, the fact that I was Mormon. Now I'm excommunicated. And then part of it was that so a student had found it and read it and didn't know how to process it and decided that it should be, you know, censored. And so, I that started a process for me, which became a long and very complicated process of trying to figure out where I stood in regard to my religion at the time. And how I could write, and whether I could still write, being part of that religion. And ultimately, the thing I decided was that two things. One is I felt like they did me a huge favor by making me feel that what I did mattered. I knew that I could be kind of punished or challenged for it, and I think very few writers these days have that experience.
Mm-hmm.
But the second thing is I finally felt that that if I could step outside of it just a little bit, that I would be able to write very honestly about what I wanted to write about. So it was that. It was partly protecting my writing that I did that. It was partly that I was drifting away from Mormonism in other ways as well.
Now, in the past, this material has appeared in somewhat disguised form. There's a novella that is a Lovecraftian novella about a cult,
yeah,
and the way in which they organize their activity. But I think this is the first time that a kind of naturalism about what a childhood growing up in a community that has featured among its relations to its own history,
mm-hmm,
a strong sense of repression.
Right.
And this is a novel about the consequences, in a sense, of not being able to have direct access to the truth of your own background and your own heritage, your,
yeah,
own history.
Yeah. It is, as you said earlier, it is my most autobiographical novel, except for The Murders, of course. But I really felt as I was going into it that I was doing a book that was realistic or naturalistic in a way that my other work wasn't, at least for the first two sections. I think it kind of goes through a transformation process. Part of it, the book, is about trying to figure out how to move from this naturalistic space into something else. But there are it's really filled with details of what it was like for me to grow up in Utah in the last part of the 20th century, in the 1980s, largely, 70s and 80s. And there's a lot of details in terms of remembering the streets and thinking about how things worked in that culture and thinking about how wrong things possibly could go within a kind of repressive religious structure. And in that sense, it was a very painful book to write, just because it felt like a return to a kind of root within myself that in some senses I've turned away from by moving out of Mormonism.
The character Rod discovers by looking through his father's letters that he has a half-brother who his father, a suicide, never acknowledged. And so it's a not just a bastard half-brother, but a half-brother who he had never met before.
Right.
He goes on his scooter one day to introduce himself. Mm-hmm. And they form a kind of symbiotic alliance, the two of them.
Yeah.
In fact, Rudd seems to feel about Lyle, or Lael as his original name is, that Lael is a form of infection who is entering him, taking him over. And it's a very interesting alliance, because here's where the things that Brian Evanson's stories are famous for begin to happen in this naturalistic novel. Usually there's a loss of boundary. One person's delusions become not contradicted but adopted by another, who then becomes still more zealous in the pursuit of delusion. And this kind of narrative, which involves charting the area, the growing area in which Rudd does not know who he is. He begins to have blackouts. He begins to find himself speaking mid-sentence in a place he doesn't remember coming to. And that does seem to be the thing that you bring to the narrative technology of these stories, the sense that living without knowing leads to a state that's very much like a nervous breakdown.
Yeah.
These characters, you know, throughout the stories become psychotic in ways that are rarely described.
Right.
And I wanted to ask you about your affinity with those materials.
Well, I think that's a very good way to state it. Living without knowing leads to a kind of condition that's like a nervous breakdown. A lot of my work in general has been about not knowing and a kind of inability to know certain things, and the way in which that ends up being a kind of a bolus or an irritant that ends up having an effect on how the self is formed or how the self tries to reform itself. But I certainly think I do have an affinity to the kind of obsessiveness that these characters have, that probably makes me very difficult to live with in some ways. And I do think that one thing I've been very interested in with this book is to take things that I felt and magnify them, and just try to predict or see where it would lead. If certain things hadn't happened for me in Mormonism, or if I hadn't had certain outlets, or if I hadn't had the family that I had, which have been very supportive of me. So in that sense, it is like kind of creating this other life and thinking about certain things that are inherent or implicit in me, and then seeing what would happen if they were explicit. I guess the other thing I would say, I mean, I had a friend who the half brother in this book is modeled after a friend of mine I knew who went a very different path from me. We were kind of together in high school, and then he ended up getting involved pretty seriously with drugs, and eventually broke that. But then, ironically enough, drowned at a drug rehabilitation swim festival. So part of it was trying to think too about, you know, how did I manage, even though we had very similar lives at a certain point, where does that divergence start? And, you know, why would one person go one way and another person go another way?
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Brian Evanson, author most recently of The Open Curtain, published by Coffee House Press. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Brian Evanson about his novel, The Open Curtain. There is a kind of quintessential moment in an early story, Two Brothers, mm-hmm. which won an O. Henry Award and was included in a recent anthology of New American Fiction by its editor, Ben Marcus. A father has had an injury. Is it a leg break? And the two sons and mother are there, and they're being told, no, we're not going to do anything. God is being called upon to heal, and God will heal. Mm-hmm. And there's a kind of paralysis and terror in that situation. But a secondary question is that maybe God has healed. Maybe this situation as such mm-hmm. is already a healing. Mm-hmm. And it's in that vacancy that later gets filled with blackouts, in a sense, where contradictory information is warring for primacy. Mm-hmm. It's almost as if this vacancy is the space of contradiction about God.
Yeah. I think that I agree with you. I think that what happens in Two Brothers for me is there's a kind of attempt on the father's part to ask the family to enter into the delusion that he has, or the belief that he has, whether it's a delusion or not is debatable. Then the question becomes: is once you enter into this delusion, how does one step out of it, or how does it deepen? I do think that, you know, the implication of that story is the situation is very bad when the father's alive, and that in some senses you could see it as an answer to prayer for the father to die. The two characters in that, the two brothers, Theron and Arl, think about the father in different ways. But then once he does die, the question really becomes, what do you make of this change in your life? How do you kind of process this? And I think for Arl, there's this sense of the house itself becoming unreal, partly because of having entered a sort of fantasy space in regard to the father's death, or taking on a kind of delusion, and that delusion having nowhere to go, moving out into the space of the house. I think that you, in the open curtain too, I mean, I think there is this sense of the paradox of not only religion, but of God, and how do we see the world in which, you know, awful things often happen as either being inspired or connected to God, or being kind of devoid of God.
Well, I call it a quintessential moment because in another award-winning story, Virtual, a wife who's had a miscarriage nevertheless continues to insist that the baby is going to be born. Mm-hmm. She buys bottles, she furnishes the nursery, mm-hmm. and then she holds towels while in her arms, swaddling the towel, yeah. while her husband insists that there's no baby there, and then discovers that he has to
yeah.
become a part of the delusional system. And
right.
he talks at work about, you know, the problems at home with the baby, and people are eventually hoping to see the baby at the work picnic. And this state of mind in which the true and untrue, or the more true, or the delusional yeah. vie for space, mm-hmm. this is at essence in the open curtain. I think the title itself alludes to a state where the paradox is seen through.
Yeah.
The boys have discovered that a murder has taken place in the past of the church, that uh-huh. a grandson of Brigham Young's has committed an act that involved a blood atonement, mm-hmm. not necessarily a part of church ritual, but part of the fringes
right.
of the history of the church, a debate whether these acts take place in fact or not, whether they were ever
yeah.
permitted or exonerated or even occurred. And so as they become fascinated with the sense that this is the same mm-hmm. event that led to the father's suicide, that it had recurred and recurred throughout Mormon history, that there are moments that amount to disappearances into invisibility,
right.
concealments.
Right.
They become involved in the black box
right.
of the unexplorable space.
Right, right. I think that Mormonism is, because they have a kind of bipartite structure where you have Sunday church services that seem very Protestant and very kind of, middle American. And then they have a temple structure in which is highly ritual. The rituals are very much based on Masonic rituals and very symbolic and, in some senses, very Catholic in that sense. It's a structure itself that is at heart schizophrenic. And then when you add this notion of secrecy, being not talking about the Mormon temple and what goes on there because it's sacred and so you keep it secret, then that ends up creating this structure that I think is a kind of basic cultural schizophrenia. And it also, because of the church's sense of history and how they think about history, the kind of denial of polygamy that's gone on at various times. The church admits they do polygamy, but they didn't actually stop it when they said they stopped it. So those sorts of things, lots of other little things like that, uncertainty about whether blood sacrifice actually occurred or not. Things like the murder squad that Porter Rockwell run. Those sorts of things. You have all these other things that are kind of. That are mostly tied to violence that circulate under the surface as well. And that as a Mormon growing up, you would hear about and not quite know what to think about or not quite know if it was true. And so I think that I did grow up in a culture that where this difference between what's real and what's not real or what's delusional is often very unclear. When I went through the Mormon temple the first time, back when I was a Mormon and was 19 or so, I had, no idea what I was getting into. Despite having grown up in the church, you have no idea. And you go in and you suddenly think, oh, my God, what exactly is happening here? And so very much the situation in the book where Lindy goes to the temple, that's very much based on my sense of what it's like to go through that ritual for the first time.
The marriage,
yeah. And so you have, you grow up thinking that the Mormon church is a certain way and knowing that there's this other thing that's secret, but that you'll have it revealed to you at some point. But still thinking you have a very good sense of what your culture is about or like. And then suddenly that kind of blows open when you participate in these kind of interior rituals. And you have to really reform and rethink everything you've thought you knew before.
These books, with their ferocity and their violence, and this is something that, has accompanied you since I think Gordon Lish wrote the flat copy on the very first book, Altman's Tongue, they take place distinctly in a post-Enlightenment world.
Uh-huh.
A world in which the rational procedures, in other words, the things that we like to think keep us civilized and, more importantly, give us the idea of a literature,
mm-hmm.
take place. How do you reconcile that extremist, ferocious, primal world, on the one hand, which resists one's desire to make literature, to make available a sanity or a permanence mm-hmm. of extreme psychological flux with being a writer?
Well, I think that I've really felt for a long time that what I wanted to do as a writer, and this is probably partly because of the controversy I faced at Brigham Young, was to look very closely and very carefully at things, often in extremes, and just see where I could get to it. I mean, I think that these books are a kind of trial for myself as a writer, or potentially a trial for readers. But I think that they're things that are very much transformative work. I'm interested in work that has a tremendous effect on me, that's likely to really change the way I think about the world after reading them. And I'd like to think that what my work is doing is pushing readers in that direction, that these are books that you'll read and that you won't forget the next few minutes.
What kind of catharsis would you most want?
I think that what I'm looking for, or what I would most like in terms of a catharsis, would be a kind of acknowledgement of all the possibilities of human behavior, and a kind of acknowledgement that violence is something that is very much part of human behavior. I think that covering that up or not thinking about it is likely to have a tremendously detrimental effect in terms of how we think about each other. I really, weirdly enough, like people a lot, but I like them a lot partly because I think I see all these sides of them. I like the strangeness of people at least as much as I like their friendliness. And so I think that rather than a catharsis, probably what I want is a kind of acknowledgement of what it means to be human, and a kind of facing of others, or others who seem different from us, and a kind of acknowledgement that in their difference, they're really not that different from what we're like.
I've been speaking with Brian Evanson, author most recently of The Open Curtain, published by Coffee House Press. Thank you, Brian, for joining
me. Thank you, Michael.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Books will take you through the ages, back to days of old, when knights were bold, and books,
books, books, books, books, books, books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing, books tell you everything, they're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus, copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.